Accession number 7325, Reel 3.
Colonel Reel 3.
Beyond Cameron Ridge, that is on the enemy side, were two immense features. One was known as Sancho, which appears on the map, and the other one was given the nickname of Briggs Peak, after, I think, an officer called Briggs in the Indian Army. To give you some idea of their height, they rose very, very steeply to about, Briggs Peak was about 6,000 feet. So to sum all this up, you had this ridge known as Cameron Ridge, which rose about 2,000 feet from the plain, again, very steeply. Then it dropped down into a small valley, and then beyond that were these two higher features. That meant that, from a point of view of a defensive position, Cameron Ridge was most unpleasant, because you were overlooked throughout daylight by the enemy on higher features. The general battalion setup on Cameron Ridge was that we had three companies forward, one on the highest point, which was on the left, and was very exposed, one in the centre, and one down to the right, near this railway tunnel, through which the old railway, which of course was disused, passed. Then battalion headquarters was level with the railway in a culvert halfway down the ridge. The valley behind Cameron Ridge, for about a mile or two, was again completely in view of the enemy, so that all supply for the unit actually holding that feature had to be done at night and into dumps at the foot of the ridge. And every battalion, including our own, when they were in defence there, had to use one complete company to ferry up rations and water from the bottom to the top, which used to take all day, carrying water cans, jerry cans, as they used to eventually became known, and also the rations. So you had three companies holding the line, one company in reserve. The left-hand company, as I said a moment ago, was extremely exposed. You couldn't move at all during daylight without the enemy taking action against you. It was so unpleasant that the system we worked on was that we used to change these companies over every 3 days. So you, in the time we were on the Cameron Ridge on the first occasion, I started off on the right by the railway tunnel, and then went to the top one on the left, and then was centre company. The other factor that was bear in mind is that it was absolutely barren. That meant that there was no shade, and one was living out in the open, being roasted by day, and then very cold at night. We had to carry everything from our original sort of base area up onto the ridge, and that meant that you had nothing except the clothes you were in, and your equipment and your arms, and one blanket per man. So that it was very hard on people there. The great advantage, for example, of the right-hand position was there was this tunnel which you could sit in during the day, or some of the company could sit in during the day, and it was cool. And, of course, one of the characteristics of the whole Eritrean campaign was this terrible lack of water. That didn't mean that there was insufficient water in the country, but there was never enough water in the units to actually be enough for the amount of water one had to drink when you were in the sun all day. We had one water carrier per battalion, and when the battalion was thirsty, the battalion would drink that down in half an hour. On the ridge, we absolutely fried. For safety reasons, we wore steel helmets, which is, of course, what we wore in battle, and abandoned our topis. And a steel helmet may be very good for repelling shell splinters and that sort of thing, but it gets absolutely like a furnace when it's had the sun on it. So you had the heat of your steel helmet as well as the heat of the sun, which how people really stood up to this, I don't know.
Do people suffer from headaches?
Oh, yes. It was at that time that the general sort of wearing away of fitness had taken place. The fact is we didn't, as I said earlier, have very good rations, people tended to get these sores. It was the conditions we were serving in were such as to sort of rarely wear you out. Now, the direct effect of that was that companies were very under strength. We were very short of officers, one way or another, anyway, and some of those had been wounded. And then the men had said the same thing, casualties from sickness and wounds, and we were down to about 75 men and two officers a company. Now, one of the effects of that is when you're actually in defence and you're doing sentry go and that sort of thing, the people are on duty all the time. There's very little spare men or reserves to help out there. So it was a very unpleasant place to be and didn't do our morale any good at all. The other thing which I particularly remember was that whereas, and again I'm speaking off the cuff here, one always worked on the basis that in the First World War, when you went up into frontline trenches, you only did a limited period of time and you knew that, usually 1 week. And then you knew you got 7 days and one used to tick them off. That was the sort of dramatic way of describing it. But when we went to defend Cameron Ridge, we simply didn't know how long we were going to be there. It was all this extraordinary fog of war. And I forget how long we were there. It was certainly a good deal longer than a week. It was about 10 days or so. And it had a general sort of luring morale effect. There we were with this almost impenetrable or prepared impenetrable features in front of us, the enemy just taking pot shot at us all the time, and we didn't seem to be achieving anything, and the head of the cannon there looked very impregnable.
How did the morale effect show itself?
Well, I think the thing was that there was a good deal of sort of talk about when on earth are we going to ever be relieved from this position, when we can get back into a sort of rear area.
Would they speak to you about it?
Yes, to a certain extent, and one would, you know, would talk to the men and so on. One didn't, of course, encourage that, but it was one of the things that when you are in a conditions of blackout, as far as information is concerned, this is something that I think that people learned, a lesson that people learned in the middle of the war and thereafter. If you keep people in total blackout, what the plans are, what you're going to do, what the future has, You're bound to get people speculating. When are we going to be relieved? Isn't this awful? And so on.
Could you do anything to lift morale?
Well, not really. The only thing that made for pleasanter conditions was when we changed over. There was something to do then. And every two or three nights, one company would swap over with another one, which meant, you know, you were up half the night doing that. And so on. But unpleasant things happened. When we were on the worst, when A Company was on the worst position, that's way up on the top on the left, the highest point, we were literally on a tiny miniature plateau. We couldn't dig in there, it was all rock. And one lived crouching behind these rocks with really one platoon right forward and two platoons slightly further back. The one in forward was absolutely exposed, except that they were behind rocks, and they couldn't move at all during the day. And I used to relieve them every 24 hours, and every night we used to swap around because of the unpleasantness. We couldn't take any food to them, whatever. They'd all had to come up at night to them. Any cooked food had to be done further back on the safe slopes and then brought forward. Well, of course, one day I heard an explosion, and one of my men had been playing around with an Italian grenade in the forward platoon and blown part of his hand off. And we had the terrible job of getting him back from this forward platoon into company headquarters. And then giving him first aid. That had resulted in two things happening. One is that, of course, we got shelled very heavily because the Italians saw movement, and my only officer got hit. And then it took all day to get a stretcher party up to the top of the hill to evacuate this one man back. My officer was hit through the shoulder so he could walk. And we required no less than 6 to 8 men to carry one stretcher down this slope. And it's very bad for morale when you've got someone fairly badly wounded and bleeding very profusely. And, of course, he was crying out all the time. As a result of that, that particular company was allowed to have morphine pills. And I had to keep on ringing up. We were in communication with the battalion corps by phone. I kept on ringing up the medical officer and asking, could I give him another one? Because he wouldn't shut up. It made me a terrible row all the time. And, of course, you can imagine what it's like when you're crouching there and being shelled, and this crying and groaning is going on all day, and you're waiting to get rid of this chap. However, he did go in the end, and I since met him after the war. He survived.
Do you think he was playing around with this out of boredom?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They were just sitting there or crouching there in their sort of rocky positions, and he was fiddling around with his arms. And one of the things we captured was a great number of small red hand grenades that the Italians used. The advantage of them was they were very light. They had very little lethal effect, but they were very light, so you could carry a large number on you, whereas the Mills grenade, which was the standard issue to the British Army, is very heavy. It's very much more effective. And he'd been playing around with this, and it blew up in his face. As a result, he lost part of his face and most of one hand.
He was the only casualty, was he?
He was the only casualty from that particular incident.
Were there any other incidents that you remember?
Well, there was one absolutely extraordinary one. When I was on the right-hand company, that's the best position, by the tunnel, we used to have a pandemonium every night, because what used to happen was that the British gunners used to bring up their guns into the valley behind Cameron Ridge, and then shell the enemy positions, and then evacuate the area before dawn, before any sort of counter-battery could take place. And so we used to have this really banging going on all night. And I suddenly got a very frantic message from the adjutant, who is with the battalion headquarters halfway up the ridge, on the safe side, level with the railway line, that the gunners had made a miscalculation of some sort, and they'd put 6 shells into battalion headquarters instead of clearing the ridge, which they could only just do from the elevation they had. They'd actually shelled battalion headquarters, and they'd wounded several of them and had killed one particular soldier there. And the extraordinary thing about this story is that the soldier was then buried on the ridge by our provost sergeant, because he was not doing anything, he was one of the town headquarters sergeants. And his name was Fusilier Howard, this soldier, I remember that. He was buried on the ridge, and which was the correct thing to do, and the temporary cross was put up with his name and number on it. And this was fairly difficult to do, because the ridge was very rocky, and there was practically no soil. And in fact, there's all a lot of dead Italian bodies lying around, and of course the smell was disgusting. Anyway, some time after that, probably about 4 or 5 days, we were relieved in the front line by the 2nd Camerons, and we went back to a rest area. And while we were in the rest area, the adjutant of the Camerons got through to our action and said that they'd found the body of a soldier, which they took to be a Royal Fusilier, because although he completely turned black in the heat, we wore most distinctive blue hose-tops as opposed to the traditional khaki hose-tops. And this message was to the effect that they'd found this body and that he was found in exactly the position that Fusilier Howard had been killed in. Well, then, about a week later, we went back onto Cameron Ridge to relieve the Camerons again for the second time. And the purveyor sergeant thought that he might be accused of having not done his job properly in burying this fusilier. So he went to this grave that the Camerons had dug and dug it up, and he found a body there, and it had no identity disc on it, so he couldn't identify it. And so he then said, well, I wonder who on earth this is. So he went back to his own grave, the one he himself had dug, and he dug there, it was empty, and he can never explain what had happened. Well, very shortly after that, the final battle of Carron took place, and it was never possible to talk to the Camerons about what had happened, that too many people were killed or wounded for that. But that sort of thing happened, and of course that got round the battalion like lightning, and there were all sorts of talks about, you know, some extraordinary thing happening, and all other sort of like these rumours that spread during the First World War about the Christ on the Messine Ridge and things like that. Had a most extraordinary effect there. They couldn't think what had happened.
You mean they were kind of ghost stories?
Ghost stories, yes.
What do you think might have been the explanation yourself?
Well, one doesn't really know, because a normal explanation would be that somehow there had been shelling or something had done which disinterred this particular grave, the body out of this grave that our purveyor sergeant had dug. But in fact, I remember talking to, I was at battalion quarters when we went back the second time to the purveyor sergeant. He said the grave was undisturbed. It was one of these inexplicable things that happened in war.
Did you find that the fusiliers were superstitious?
No, I don't think so. You get awfully jumpy in a position like that. Mobile warfare is all right because you never have time to think. But when you're sitting back in a defensive position, you begin to gossip. That's what it is. It's anything you have to do. You can't read a book or anything like that. And sort of rumours get round. And this, as I said before, it was accentuated by the fact that we were never, under any circumstances, given any idea really what we were going to do in the future and what the real plans were. I admit there was obviously, of course, a security aspect there, but we could have been helped a bit.
Just going back to something you said earlier, that I think you hinted that Montgomery made a difference.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me how?
Oh, yes, because Montgomery, again, I'll be absolutely honest, I never served under Montgomery. I have served in the 8th Army when he left, after he left. But Montgomery, from the very start, before Alamein, used to go round all formations and units, get all the troops to sit round him in the desert with a map board, and he used to tell them in very plain language what was going to happen. And of course they all thought this was wonderful, and they thought it was even better when it really did happen. It wasn't just sort of bluff. And he did that regularly.
And coming back to the ghost stories, did you feel that it had a bad morale effect?
Oh, yes. That sort of thing doesn't do anybody any good. They begin to wonder what's happening.
Did you do anything about it?
Well, again, let me say that the end of this story was really brought by the fact that the final battle took place, and there really wasn't time to do anything. There was a certain amount of back chat for some days, and then we took part in the final battle, and then that was that as far as Carron was concerned, and the thing was forgotten.
What happened next?
Well, we were relieved by the Camerons and went back to a so-called rest area some miles back. And during that time, a plan was made to attack round the right flank of Carron through a valley which was really the extension of the valley behind Cameron Ridge called Happy Valley. This was just a nickname. And we were to take part in that. What it amounted to was one of the battalions of my brigade, that was 5th Indian Infantry Brigade of 4th Indian Division, that is the 4th, 6th Rajputana Rifles, was to move into this valley at night, and then in the early morning attack through a narrow saddle or col in the mountains some miles to the right of the main features in front of Kerin. And we were to move in behind them and be in reserve to follow through. Well, I don't know, again, it's not for me to criticize one's superiors, but it was struck me as a most hopeless operation. You were sending a battalion up the mountains through a narrow gap between two features. Even if they got through there, they would never have had the ammunition, the men, the supplies, all that matter, neither would we, ever to carry on from there to get all the way into the town of Kerin. It was, to my mind, a complete misconception. If it had been part of what I call a feint, a cover plan, while a main attack was taking place elsewhere, I could have understood that. But as far as I know, it was not thought to be that. I thought it was, in itself was supposed to be a proper attack. Anyway, I remember going forward to various features and one's field glasses reconnoitering the Happy Valley. And then one night, and again the dates are not absolutely clear in my own mind, but I think it was about between the 12th and 15th of February, we moved at night forward and then to the right into Happy Valley while the 4th-6th Rajputana Rifles were ahead of us. There were various other units. I remember there was at least an AK-AK unit moved in with us, a light AK-AK unit. And there was absolute chaos in the valley. Most of the floor of the valley was very soft sand. It was really dried riverbed. And vehicles got stuck. And we had the greatest difficulty in getting forward. And in the early hours, the Rajputana Rifles attacked. And of course, there was a terrific noise, because in the mountains you get this reverberation, say, with all the guns firing. And they fought very gallantly all that morning and all that day, while we were held in reserve in the valley, which is in itself not a particularly sort of a pleasant thing, because you never know when you're going to get a move on and get forward. And you also... We were in a rather flat valley with a certain number of stunted trees, but not much cover. We were very exposed. And, of course, as ill luck would have it, we were quite heavily attacked by Italian aircraft there, which was nothing we could do about it. We were dug in, but the fact was that we were exposed. Well, we were there all that day, and having had ourselves a few casualties, including the CO was hit, and the adjutant was hit, and then... that next night, it was decided to withdraw the Rajputana Rifles, because the fact is that they'd been given a task they couldn't possibly succeed in, I believe. So they withdrew to us that night and got out of the valley, and then either we were there, I think we were there probably another day, and I can't remember this certain, anyhow, perhaps the third night, maybe in the same night as the Rajputana Rifles withdrew, they eventually pulled us out. It really wasn't a very satisfactory operation. I don't think it could ever have succeeded. It certainly caused unnecessary casualties, both from the Rajputana Rifles' point of view and us. And it certainly didn't do our morale very much good, I don't think.
How much did you personally know about the objectives before the attack started? Were you given a complete briefing?
No, only a limited briefing that we had, of course, orders to move forward and be in reserve, and we knew that the 4-6 Rajputana Rifles were attacking across this gap in the mountains. What we didn't know was how far they were supposed to go, what their final objective was, whether there was a plan to leapfrog us through, or whether there were any other forces to go through. I certainly didn't know that, and I very much doubt that my commanding officer did.
How did the effect on morale show itself amongst the troops afterwards?
Well, not that... it's not a thing you can sort of naturally, immediately recognise. It just meant that people were getting more and more tired. I mean, every time you do a thing like that, it means you get three sleepless nights and three sleepless days, or whatever the generation was. We'd been about 10 days in the line on Cameron Ridge, and we didn't really get any sleep there. And it's a sort of wasting away process. People were generally getting very tired.
What happened next?
Well, then we withdrew out of that valley, went back to our rest area, and almost at once we relieved the 2nd Camerons, 2nd Battalion of the Cameron Highlanders, on Cameron Ridge again. And I'll skip the next week, or whatever period was, because that was the same sort of routine in the line. It must have been about 10 days, I think. And then that took us well into March, really, from the first 10 days or so of March. And then the operations for the final attack on Cairn were put in hand. And all that meant, as far as my battalion was concerned, was that the battalion was to be held in reserve on Cameron Ridge, while, as far as our particular front was concerned, the Camerons were to attack both this mountain called Sanchel and Brigadier's Peak, and they were to do that through the gap between Cameron Ridge and the feature on its left, through there, down into the valley in front of Cameron Ridge, and then up these two features there, you see?
Up Briggs Peak and Sanchel.
There were, of course, other attacks going on all along the front, both the left and right of that, but the one that my battalion was concerned with was that attack. Because it was a very broad feature to attack, and in my humble opinion, far too big a feature for one battalion, one of the companies, the Royal Fusiliers, was put under command of the Camerons, and that was my company. There were five, in other words, the Camerons had five companies. And during the night of the 14th, 15th of March, all the troops that were in that going to operate in that area, and I imagine elsewhere, were moved forward. And so I remember a very sleepless night of the 14th, 15th, because the whole of the area on the safe side of Cameron Ridge along the railway line was absolutely solid with troops. My company was already in reserve as far as the Royal Fusiliers was concerned. In other words, it wasn't one of the three forward companies. And it was waiting on the railway line level as part of the Camerons. Well, the attack went in at dawn, and like all other attacks that we'd had in Eritrea in the mountains, the noise was absolutely terrific. And you can see the effect of the mountains. This is a photograph of the barrage and bursting shells going on, and the noise was simply colossal. I merely mention that because one of the things I remember most about war is the effect on people of noise. In peacetime, one's no idea how noisy a battle is. In the final battle of Cairn, I can remember in the first 24 hours only once being able to get a sentence out without having to repeat it. In 24 hours, because the noise was so terrific, and that was between 1 and 2 in the morning of the 15th of March. It was between 1 and 2 in the morning of the 16th of March. Anyway, the Camerons, and I'm here describing only their particular battle, attacked, I think, probably on a three, but maybe in four company front. I think it must have been four companies, two companies against Mount Sanchel and two companies against Briggs Peak. And this went in, and about 10 o'clock in the morning, the CO of the Camerons, who was a very nice person called Colonel Anderson, sent for me and said they're having great problems holding the positions they've captured, and I want you to go forward and reinforce them with your company. When I got